It's The Record on KUOW with Steve Scherr. I'm Marcy Silman. If you're interested in education, you may know Bill Ayers as a former teacher and theorist. If you're an American of a certain age, you may know him for his stand against the Vietnam War and for his involvement with the radical group The Weather Underground. But chances are you first heard of Bill Ayers in 2008. That's when a national TV audience heard presidential debate moderator George Stephanopoulos link then-Senator Barack Obama to Bill Ayers. As the presidential campaign went on, Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin accused Obama of palling around with terrorists, and I think that would have been Bill Ayers and his wife, Bernadine Dorn. Bill Ayers recounts the months and of the presidential campaign and more in his second volume of memoir. The book is called Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. And Bill Ayers, it's great to meet you. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you so much, Marcy. Pleasure
to
be here.
Let's just get this out of the way. How well did you actually know Barack and Michelle Obama in 2008?
You know, when he called me a guy around the neighborhood, he got it exactly right. I thought he was a guy around the neighborhood. In other words, small town, small community, Hyde Park. We would see them in the supermarket. We would see them in the bookstore. He and I served on a couple of boards together. We went to a few conferences together. Bernadine knew Michelle long before we knew them together because they were at the same law firm. So it was, yes, we knew one another. No, we never shared a milkshake with two straws. We weren't that kind of friends. But I knew him like thousands of other people knew him.
So the fact that Sarah Palin would describe your relationship as palling around was meant to tar Barack Obama with the brush of your political past.
Of course, and it's worth remembering that narrative was begun by Hillary Clinton. The narrative, and it lost for her, and then it lost for McCain Palin. But the idea was, here's this charismatic, brilliant young man coming out of Illinois. How well do we know him? Well, not at all. But we do know Reverend Wright, or the cartoon of Reverend Wright, because Reverend Wright is a substantial, accomplished person. We do know the cartoon of the Palestinian scholar Rashid Khalidi, and then there's me. But the point is that those characterizations were dishonest from the start. But the worst part is just what you point to, the guilt by association.
Well, it's interesting because, as you say, you knew him from the neighborhood. You knew him by reputation. But you describe Barack Obama at the time in 2008 as a middle-of-the-road Democrat. Some people condemn him at this point in time as being further to the right of middle of the road. And
well, I actually think I don't define him so much that way. He defined himself all during the campaign. He said, I'm a moderate, pragmatic, middle of the road, compromising politician. The right looked at it and said, no, he's a secret socialist who pals around with terrorists. The left looked at it and said, I think he's winking at me. But he wasn't winking. He is exactly as he described himself. And if you look at his policy stands in Illinois, his history in Illinois, moderate, middle of the road, pragmatic, compromising.
Why did you support him?
I'm not sure what you mean, support
him. In 2008. I mean, I know you didn't vote, but...
Oh, I did vote.
Did you vote?
For the second time in my life, I voted for a Democrat at the top of the ticket. Guess who else I voted for? George McGovern. And the reason was simple. I had no illusions about George McGovern and none about Barack Obama, but I was voting for peace, and I felt that it was the right thing to do. In Obama's case, I was voting against white supremacy. I didn't have any illusions that he would bring us the promised land, and I still don't believe that. So I'm not disillusioned or disappointed. He's doing exactly what he said he would do. But there's another thing he said during the campaign. When asked who Martin Luther King would support, he said he'd support none of us. He'd be in the streets building a movement for justice. That's strikes me as just right. That's what I want to do.
I'm talking with William Ayers, and if, like me, you've been around for a while, you know that he and his wife, Bernadine Dorn, have a long history of radical politics, but you spent a whole lot more of your life, Bill Ayers, as a college professor talking about education than you did about radical politics. But I think that the idea of a certain kind of world is still at the heart of where you and your wife come from in terms of work and play and family.
Very much so. I mean, I think that what the book really is about, and what I try to do in the book through narrative, through story, through anecdote, is I try to tell the story of 30 years, 40 years of trying to stay true to the values that ignited our passions when we were young. Values about global justice or peace, values about racial justice, values about economic justice and fairness. These are still the things we care about and try to live out in our daily lives, but they, you know, times change and the world moves on. So we also had kids and we were both teachers.
One of the funniest parts of the book was a description of a dinner party that you and your wife donated donated as an auction item to a nonprofit. I think it was a humanities organization, if I'm not mistaken. Can you tell a bit about that?
Sure. We were on the board of a group called the Public Square. We still are. But it's a part of the Illinois Humanities Council. And we often donate dinners. I mean, the way the book starts is at a dinner, and we often find ourselves hosting NGOs and social justice organizations. And we had volunteered to serve dinner for anyone who bid on a dinner for six, that we would serve and that we would make. And it wasn't an unusual thing for us. We've done this dozens of times. But there was a little button on the silent auction, which was press this and you can get it instantly for $3,500. And Tucker Carlson, the right-wing commentator, pressed that button and won dinner. And it caused pandemonium in the Illinois Humanities Council because no one was sure that we should do it. I never wavered. I thought we should absolutely do it. Instantly, we got $3,500 from Tucker Carlson. What the hell? He showed up for dinner with Andrew Breitbart, the kind of lunatic, you know, kind of bomb thrower of the right, and a few, you know, reporters from the Daily Caller. We had a marvelous dinner party together. And at the end of it, I think their heads were spinning because they expected something that they didn't get.
Well, throughout this book, you write about encounters with Tucker Carlson's or people who are even further to the right than Tucker Carlson's a libertarian, I believe.
That's right. So he's a right libertarian.
A right libertarian. Yeah. A left libertarian.
Left libertarians are more anarchists, but that's okay.
But you have had many an encounter, and it seems like you sort of pursue this with a philosophy of engagement. You actually want to have conversations.
Absolutely. Part of the book is called Talking with the Tea Party because since 2008, I've never had a speaking engagement except right here where I don't get picketed. So I get picketed by the Tea Party. And I have a tradition of going out to talk to them while they're picketing me. And it often leads to some amusing kind of encounters. But you're absolutely right. My feeling is if you don't talk with the possibility of persuading others, then what are you doing? And if you don't listen with the possibility of learning something, what are you doing? Let's have a dialogue.
Did you feel that way at the age of 22?
No, I think at the age of 22, especially there was a 6 month or year and a half period where I think we descended into real dogmatism, real self-righteousness, and we're well known for that. And I've apologized for it from then on.
I'm not asking about apology, but I'm thinking about the difference. It's a difference of age, I think, maybe, and life experience,
partly,
too.
It's partly experience. It's partly a state of mind. I think that the intensity of 1968-69, where there was a war raging, where 6,000 people a week were being murdered by my government, that led to a sense of urgency that is hard to remember or describe. But I really do regret any turns towards self-righteousness. I think we need to talk. And frankly, this will strike you perhaps as surprising. I've always felt that I'm in the majority in this country. I've never felt like a minority. I've always felt on the 10 most important issues, if I frame it correctly, I'm in the big majority.
And you do recount instances where you have those kinds of conversations and do find agreement. One of the things I was wondering about, given what's happening in the world today, and in fact, in the last 2 hours, we've been talking about the NSA spying 45 years ago at the height of your radical activism. I would imagine that somebody had records on you and Bernadine. In fact, I know that's true.
Absolutely. I mean, the COINTELPRO program, which was only revealed during the Watergate scandal, was clear that whatever paranoid fantasies we had about being watched were underestimations.
How is what's happening now different, or is it different?
It's only different in that it's more intense and more pervasive. I mean, 1984 is no longer a theory. It's a fact on the ground. We are all under surveillance at all times. The wonderful thing about WikiLeaks, about Chelsea Manning, about Edward Snowden, is they represent us watching them watch us. And I think that's worthwhile.
In today's New York Times, the reporter Peter Baker had an article about whether the buck actually did stop with President Obama, as Harry Truman used to say. And I was wondering, in thinking about talking to you, where should the buck stop where it comes to responsibility for NSA spying or responsibility for broken technology that's meant to implement the Affordable Care Act?
Well, clearly the buck should not only stop with the president, it should stop every level up the line. So for me to listen to Dianne Feinstein be shocked that these things are going on, and she's the head of the Senate you know, Intelligence Committee is nuts. I mean, she's responsible. The Senate is responsible. We have a Senate and a Congress that acts like a hectic, overheated bazaar where everything's for sale. Nobody takes responsibility. So, yes, political leaders should take responsibility. And frankly, we should take responsibility. We are responsible for this government. We're not subjects of theirs. We are the sovereign, and we have to get serious about organizing ourselves and acting like a sovereign.
Do you see glimmers of hope anywhere?
Everywhere, especially among young people who are smarter, hipper, more in tune than we ever were at that age. But also from things like Occupy. The day before Occupy happened, good people like you couldn't have predicted it. The day after, it seems inevitable. Those kinds of things are going to happen with increasing frequency because we live in a world out of balance.
Bill Ayers, his new book is called Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. He's going to speak at 7 tonight at Elliott Bay Books on Capitol Hill. It's been a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much, Marcy.
It's The Record.